From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm John McKay, sitting in today for Chris Boyd. John C. Calhoun, perhaps you remember the name from history class. While the former vice president died before the Civil War began, his arguments in support of the South, slavery, and states' rights were major factors in the decision of 11 states later to secede from the Union. Principle was everything to John Calhoun, so much so he resigned the vice presidency to defend his ideas in the Senate. And some of those ideas have survived. Baylor University professor Robert Elder has written a fascinating new book entitled Calhoun, American Heretic. And in it, he argues, and this is a quote, "We do not have to honor John C. Calhoun, nor should we, but he has not left us the luxury of forgetting him." Robert Elder joins us. Professor, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
So I want to get this out of the way at the very beginning. This book is not your defense of John C. Calhoun's ideas or slavery.
No, it is not. It is basically an argument that we simply can't forget how important he was to our country's history, even as we are kind of reconfiguring how we remember him, especially in the public spheres, like statues and names on buildings and things like that. So it's really just an appeal that it's all the more important to remember him historically as we're doing that.
You know, the easy thing I think for people today is to connect Calhoun to people like Dylann Roof, the mass shooter in South Carolina back in 2015. But one of your arguments in the book seems to be that there are other ways that the ideas that Calhoun put forward can really still be seen in our society.
Yeah, I think I started writing the book after the horrific shootings in Charleston, and I noticed that people were connecting those events to Calhoun's legacy, and I realized there hadn't been a biography of him in a long time. So I actually started out on this project because of those events and making those connections. But as I did the research for the book, I realized that there are lots of ways in which Calhoun's ideas are still relevant, both in the areas of the racial history of our country and how that's still impacting our politics, and his ideas about constitutional theory and government, which are still broadly relevant even outside the United States. And one of the arguments that I make is that Americans seem to think that secession is a dead letter, and we hope it is in the United States, but it's not globally at all. It's only accelerated since the Civil War.
Yeah, there really is some irony in John Calhoun's history. Unfair treatment was likely something he heard a lot about as a child. He got predecessors who left Ulster as Presbyterians. You talk about and how they came, they were not accorded the same rights as members of the Church of England in the Irish Republic. So he probably heard a lot of ideas about unfair treatment, even as a child, from relatives, right?
Yeah, that's right. The history of Presbyterians in Ireland was that they were kind of doubly disadvantaged. They were Irish in a British empire. And then they were Presbyterian in a country that was run by the Anglican Church. And I think that shaped Calhoun. He was not born in Ireland, but he grew up with a father who had been. And then the conflict between the upcountry of South Carolina and the Lowcountry, as Calhoun was growing up, kind of cemented those tendencies or those sensitivities in Calhoun, because when Calhoun was growing up as a young man, the upcountry, his region of South Carolina, was kind of locked in a struggle with the Lowcountry, complaining that they did not have adequate representation in the state government. And it wasn't until 1808 that they kind of forged a compromise that Calhoun looked back to for the rest of his life as a sort of model for what eventually the North and the South could forge. But the irony of that, both in Ireland and then in the colonies and what became in the United States, is that concept, that extreme sensitivity to being disadvantaged within a constitutional system or a political system, exists alongside the subjugation of Black people, alongside the political and economic subjugation of Black people. And one of the things that I try to explain in the book is how what seems to us like this massive contradiction made sense to Calhoun. And we tend to explain Calhoun, I think, in terms of someone who kind of deceived himself about how these two things work together. But in fact, one of the arguments of the book is that Calhoun did not have the conception of natural rights. He did not think about rights in the same way that we do today or that Thomas Jefferson did. He had a very conservative version of rights that runs back to people like Edmund Burke, that rights are inherited. They are the product of the political and historical circumstances into which people are born. And therefore, slavery for him was not a contradiction of his rights. And in fact, you know, he would go on to argue that slavery was perfectly suited to the sort of democracy that he wanted to instill in the United States, which was a democracy of white people.
Yeah, also going on at this time, this continuing idea about Black people being the curse of Ham that I'm sure people read about in the Bible and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I try to chart how Calhoun is living in the midst of a shifting opinions among Europeans and white Americans, at least, about racial difference. That when he's growing up, there is there's a popular theory of kind of environmental theories of race, that the differences between white and Black people were the product of environment, and the natural outgrowth of that, of course, is that there is an opening in that theory for the idea that eventually these differences will disappear. But by the time that Calhoun begins making his most famous arguments in favor of slavery as a positive good by the 1830s, that consensus has shifted. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that Calhoun believed with reason that his arguments about racial slavery as a good thing because Black people were inherently inferior, he believed that that was totally in line with the scientific consensus that was emerging in his world. And today we would call this pseudoscience, of course, but the major scientific figures of his day who studied racial theories were concurring by the 1830s, certainly by the 1850s, that there were inherent, deeply ingrained racial differences between white and Black people that were not going to go away. They were inherent, and this was the creation of both whiteness as a racial category and Blackness as a racial category. So Calhoun's arguments were kind of in line with a lot of the modern theories about race in his day in ways that I don't think we've fully appreciated.
You know, with the new Constitution, there comes really an avoidance of a couple of words, slavery being one. And the other one, interestingly, is nation. The concern is that there are maybe differences of opinion over the idea of what exactly a nation is. And this is something Calhoun seemed to adhere to, right?
Yeah, I would say that the shift that Calhoun goes through is that early in his career, when he's in the House of Representatives during the War of 1812, and probably especially as Secretary of War under James Monroe, which is a part of his career that I think is often overlooked, Calhoun is one of the primary figures who is trying to actually forge the United States into a modern nation state in the way that he understands that. Because he understands that it's not actually that yet, that the Constitution doesn't actually create that. It avoids the word. There were lots of different understandings of what exactly the Union represented constitutionally. And Calhoun very much in the first part of his career tries to create a nation by systems of internal improvements, a national bank, his efforts to tie the entire country together when he's Secretary of War through expansion into the West. But then the nullification crisis in 1832 and 1833, which you mentioned at the beginning, really is a turning point where he begins to, he shifts emphasis. I think we can overemphasize, it wasn't a complete reversal, but he shifts emphasis to the argument that the Union is a compact among what are essentially sovereign entities. And the best—
Yeah, he didn't even like the word nation, if I remember right.
No, he doesn't like the word. He argues explicitly in after the 1830s or in the 1830s that the United States is not a nation, although he had used that word frequently in his early speeches in describing what the United States should be. And one of the interesting things is that the editors of his papers, early editors, not the editors of the modern version of his papers, actually went back and edited out some of those early references or changed it to the word country or things like that, because there was an obvious contradiction there. But yeah, he is, I think the best comparison today would be something like the EU, that Calhoun believes that the Union, that the Constitution creates something like the EU, where it's a compact among sovereigns, but that every state retains ultimate sovereignty, the ultimate adjudication of their participation in the Union, which obviously is a very different way of understanding the country than other people at that time had and than we have today.
One of the interesting things to me about John C. Calhoun, Professor, is that his concern over tyranny of the majority, and by that I mean the white majority, that animates a lot of Calhoun's thinking. He's really concerned about the North forcing an end to slavery.
Yeah, this is the concern that produces Calhoun's greatest theoretical contribution to political science. It's really the reason that political scientists are still interested in him today. For instance, there's a wonderful recent book by a political scientist named James Reed that is kind of working through Calhoun's theories that he developed, specifically the idea of the concurrent majority, the idea that every important interest in a society should have veto power over important legislation. And Calhoun develops that over the course of his career because of exactly the concern that you're talking about, that he sees over the course of his lifetime, the growing prospect of a Northern majority or a Northern and Western majority that would stop slavery from expanding westward and then eventually have the political power to end slavery itself. And where the founding generation, people like James Madison, had argued that the very size of the country would mitigate this problem of majoritarianism, because you would have so many different factions that the majority would be constantly shifting, and therefore there was no real danger to a minority in the system, because they could always the next year become part of the majority. Calhoun's insight or opinion is that by the 1830s, certainly by the 1840s, what had happened was essentially two large sections, each with very different interests and culture, that were not going to shift over time. And the majority that he saw developing was not going to go away or suddenly become more amenable to slavery. And so his concern was to kind of construct constitutional safeguards that would keep slavery politically safe. And nullification was not directly related to slavery. It was related to the tariff. But clearly, it falls into the same category of being concerned about what a majority could do, because the tariff had been passed by majorities in Congress. And then by the end of his life, in his very last speech in the Senate in 1850, Calhoun recommends a constitutional amendment that would institute a dual executive, North and South, each one of them with veto power. And this was his way of kind of solving this emerging problem that he saw in a way that would protect the South permanently within the constitutional system. And I think there's two ways to look at this. One of them, if you are somebody who believes that the United States should function as a majoritarian democracy at the federal level, then Calhoun's constitutional efforts really look like an effort to engineer minority rule, or at the very least, paralysis. And there's no question, well, I think there's no question that's what they would have produced at the federal level, and what on occasion he did produce at the federal level. But to really understand what Calhoun was trying to do, or at least what he said he was trying to do, the way that he expressed in positive terms what he was trying to do, was that he was trying to make space for democracy to operate further down the spectrum at the state level.
Yeah, he's worried too. I mean, we always see this as North and South. He's worried too about developments that he's seeing in the western region because of free soilers and that this idea about where slavery could be and could not be.
Right. His final speech in the Senate in 1850 is during the crisis over admitting California to the Union and whether it would come in as a free state or not. And that had some real vast political implications for the balance of power between the North and the South. And it was not an argument necessarily about whether slavery would actually go to those places. Even Calhoun acknowledged that it was very unlikely that slavery would take root in places like California or mm-hmm. Oregon. But what he objected to was a majority in Congress excluding slavery from those places, because he believed that was unconstitutional, because it violated the idea of the Union as a trustee for the interests of all the states. And so it was actually a very kind of fine theoretical point, but it was a hill that Calhoun was willing to die on by 1850.
You know, Calhoun, and you've mentioned this before, was really a chief proponent of some ideas that were kind of argued first by Jefferson and Madison, and I'm talking about interposition and nullification. We heard those ideas also in the mid '60s coming from George Wallace, Lester Maddox, who was in Georgia. But these ideas that somehow the states had should have the right to determine which federal laws they were going to enforce and not enforce, and Calhoun really talked about those.
Yeah, he believed he was just developing something that that one of his political idols, Thomas Jefferson, had already laid out in 1798 in the Kentucky Resolution, which was in protest of the John Adams administration's Alien and Sedition Acts, which suppressed free speech and immigrants' rights and other things. And Jefferson and James Madison and other figures closer to Calhoun's day, like John Taylor of Caroline in Virginia, had all used this concept of state interposition. Jefferson even used the word nullification in his original draft of the Kentucky Resolution. But none of them had developed the mechanism of how this would actually work. They asserted that this right existed, but nobody had actually worked out theoretically how it would work constitutionally. And that's what Calhoun does in 1828 in the South Carolina Exposition in opposition to the tariff, and then in his Fort Hill address in 1831 and in his speeches during the nullification crisis. And the main contribution that Calhoun makes is that he says nullification has to be done by a state convention because it has to invoke the power of the people, because that was the original power that made the Constitution. So it can't be done by a state legislature. And he envisioned a process where a challenge to a federal law by a state would set off a larger process whereby all the states would have to have constitutional conventions, and they would either specifically grant the power in question to the federal government or deny it to them. And Calhoun, this is often viewed as a completely defensive and even reactionary doctrine, and it is that for sure. But the way that Calhoun packaged it was as a mechanism for the continual perfection of the Constitution. He packages it in very utopian language where he says, this is a way that the Constitution can be constantly adjusted in light of experience. And his opponents, people like Andrew Jackson or people like John Quincy Adams, saw this as a complete farce, as a simply a cover for what would be a constitutional disaster. But Calhoun always saw nullification as a successful experiment, even though it almost provoked a war between Andrew Jackson and South Carolina.
You know, until recently in Charleston, Professor, a very immense monument to John C. Calhoun stood tall. It was removed as part of the controversy that we have today with Confederate monuments, as that continues to swirl around us. This was, in fact, I think, the second Calhoun statue for Charleston. But this was something that people saw and had some issues on for very different reasons. Some of the supporters liked it because of who he was, and some of the opponents really disliked it because of his ideas and what he had called for.
Yeah, I think the history of the monument is really a way of charting how Calhoun has been remembered since his death. And I wrote about this in the epilogue. I was relying heavily on other historians like Tom Brown and Ethan Keitel and Blaine Roberts, who have written about memory in Charleston and about the Calhoun monument. But originally, the effort to raise a monument began right after Calhoun's death, during a time period when he became a sort of figurehead for a new Southern nation. So he was associated with the kind of Southern nationalism because Calhoun had offered the most aggressive form of the South's complaint within the Union. And this is something that was a common aspect of a lot of proto-nationalist movements in the mid-19th century. Then after the Civil War, the monument still had not been finished or raised. And after the Civil War, you have this imperative of reconciliation. And so people emphasize when they finally do actually raise the monument, in the 1880s, they emphasize Calhoun as a figure of reconciliation, as somebody who had worked to preserve the Union, which of course is one way of seeing Calhoun. one of the things I show in the book is that Black people in Charleston, of course, never viewed Calhoun that way, that there is a long seam of memory in Black America that's very consistent, much more consistent than his memory among white Americans or white Charlestonians or white Southerners, where they associate him almost exclusively with white supremacy and slavery. And that's true when the monument goes up. You can find references to the monument being vandalized by unknown people. And we have accounts of Black Charlestonians saying they carried rocks and sticks to throw at the monument in the 1890s. And over the course of the 20th century, Calhoun's memory shifts as the country kind of suppresses the memory of slavery as a cause of the Civil War and puts forward this version of the war that it was mainly about constitutional issues. And obviously, part of Calhoun's legacy as a constitutional thinker fits in with that. So he's emphasized primarily as a constitutional thinker. But then beginning, just a few years ago, but especially with the shootings in Charleston, I think there was just a sea change in how he is viewed and remembered, and the parts of his legacy that Black Americans, Black Charlestonians had always lifted up began to be accepted and put forward also by white Americans.
Yeah, the statue in question, which is now gone, if I remember right, when it was first put up, It was defaced on a fairly regular basis, and then they took it apart and put a column in it. So it was very high and looking down, a very tall statue, looking down at a lot of people, and people were objecting even to that one.
Yeah, that's right. There's or at least the people who've studied this most decisively, who are the historians I named at the beginning of this, there's no way to prove that they put the statue up on the on this huge column pedestal to get it out of reach, but there are good reasons to believe that that was one of the reasons that they did it. It also is a completely different statue, because the original statue, by all accounts, was pretty ugly, and there was broad consensus that there needed to be a shift. But when they put a new statue in, they put it as high up as they could to get it out of reach of these unknown vandals.
Yeah, Clemson University is actually built on Fort Hill Plantation, which is Calhoun's home. If I remember right, that school has now renamed its honors program, which was once called the John C. Calhoun Honors College. Others around the country seem to be distancing themselves from him as well. I'm thinking of Yale, from which he graduated. I think he was valedictorian.
Yeah, that was all. Well, certainly the controversy at Yale over Calhoun College, which was a residential college named for Calhoun in 1933, when he was enjoying the kind of height of his popularity as a constitutional thinker. That was another one of the controversies that caught my eye that started me writing this book. And then, of course, Clemson University, which I attended for undergraduate degree, took his name off the Honors College just last summer when the statue went down in Charleston as well. And I think that's, this is obviously going forward, we are going to remember Calhoun differently or not at all in our public commemoration of the American past. I think that part of the reason I finally called the book American Heretic is that I think that title captures his place at the moment in our national consciousness or identity. And the whole book, in essence, is sort of a response to that, which is that I think it's appropriate and long past time to take down some of these statues and rename some of these buildings if we want to accurately represent what we want our nation to be, what it is now. But a historian's job in that environment is to double down on telling the history, and that's what the book represents.
Yeah, I mean, in essence, what I got from the book is your belief that we cannot walk away from his ideas, but by the same token, it's a mistake to simply ignore them.
Yeah, I think they're too, they are too prevalent in our world today. I mean, Calhoun's story provokes questions that are perennial questions in any democracy. One of which is, are we creating equality among some people at the expense of other people? Another one is, what is the proper role and extent of authority of majoritarianism in our system, and what is the proper role of a minority opposition, and what is the balance between protecting minority rights but not going so far that you are shading over into minority rule? And our arguments about federal power during the election, right now the arguments that are going on over the filibuster, and clearly our struggle to come to terms with our nation's racial history, all point directly to Calhoun's history and the fact that we can't forget that history. We have to keep telling it and talking about it.
How did the book, putting this book together, change your view and your impressions of John Calhoun?
Well, one of the things that shifted was I saw a different side of him than the very cerebral side that I had seen initially, and that attracted me to him as a kind of interesting figure. His private correspondence with his children in particular, his daughter Anna just presents a very different side of him, a very warm, more emotional side of him than I think has made it into any of the popular conceptions of him. And that's kind of an interesting thing to try to navigate with a figure who had such reprehensible public views, but in private is such a warm father figure. The other thing that I think I came to more fully understand was why people so often compared Calhoun to the figure of Satan in John Milton's poem, Paradise Lost. Yeah, which I was an English major. If you know the poem, Satan is the most compelling figure in that poem, because he makes these arguments that you know are at some level, somewhere inside them, they're wrong, sometimes on the face of them, in Calhoun's case, and yet they're made with such skill that you are drawn to the power of the logic. And I think that is something that in reading through Calhoun's speeches, and especially his writings, like the two treatises on government that he leaves behind that are published posthumously, you see why he was such an incredibly influential figure, because the power of his logic is so powerful and so almost irresistible at certain points. And so people portrayed him as this figure of almost satanic brilliance. And I think that was something I hadn't quite understood. I had dismissed his arguments without really struggling with them before. So those things certainly changed.
Yeah, I mean, he's part of what was called the great triumvirate. His oratory, his ideas, his influence in terms of the national government at the period in which he's at his height.
Yeah, in 1957, John F. Kennedy, who's at that time a freshman senator, chairs a committee, and they're charged with coming up with the five most important or influential senators in American history. And three of the five who end up on that list are Calhoun, Henry Clay, and Daniel Webster, who were the great triumvirate that you're talking about. So three out of the five, even in the mid-20th century, came from this one period of a couple decades in the mid-19th century, when the Senate was really, arguably, but it was the most important arena in American politics. And you had these three kind of titans battling it out frequently in the Senate, which is an incredibly dramatic period in American history.
The Calhouns had, 10 children? Some of whom died, like their father, died from tuberculosis.
He had three children who died as infants or very young children. Of the children who survive, it's almost impossible to diagnose it definitively at this distance, but it sure seems as if tuberculosis ran through the family and killed not only Calhoun, but most of his children, except for his daughter, Anna. And this is just an aspect of 19th century life that I don't think we quite grasp or understand, that this was not uncommon at all. Tuberculosis was one of the scourges of the 19th century. You could live with it for years, and it could come and go and then eventually kill you in a matter of days or weeks.
I want to end with I guess your thoughts on the quote that I used at the very beginning of those, which also serves as the very end, I should tell people, of your book. We do not have to honor John C. Calhoun, nor should we, but he has not left us the luxury of forgetting him. So what exactly did you mean by that?
I think one of the things that we're struggling with as a society right now is how to remember our history in honest ways. And one of the distinctions that I feel is often lost is the difference between honoring and understanding someone or something. And so, for instance, many of the people who argue that we can't take down statues because that's erasing history, I understand what they're saying. I think there's the seed of a real critique there, which is that there is a danger. This is what the committee at Yale said when they reported their when they gave their report on Yale College there. They said there is a danger that when we take down things like statues or rename buildings, that it's simply a way of forgetting the history or not having to confront it, right? But I think that that things like renaming buildings and taking down statues are not erasing history. But in order to make sure that they aren't that, we have to do the work of actually remembering the history and telling it, and the work of understanding it appropriately. Because as I say at the end of the book, if we simply dismiss Calhoun as an outdated reactionary, if we associate him with the failed political project of the Confederacy as a way of kind of separating him from his role in American history or from our identity as Americans, we are going to miss the ways in which his thought and his actions are still relevant and operating all around us today.
Calhoun, American Heretic is the name of the book. The author has been our guest, Baylor historian Robert Elder. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Use any podcast app to get the Think podcast, or go to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm John McKay, in today for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.